koshas, kleshas, samskaras, and non-dualism. Lions and tigers and bears. Oh my. Okay, let's dive into a little bit more about the foundations of yoga psychology. So it's not necessary to discuss this stuff with your students per se, but it is important to have an understanding of it for yourself so it can inform your teaching and your approach to your own mental health and wellness. Let's start with the koshas. So koshas are sheaths of misidentification that are responsible for our belief in being a separate, limited I or me who is born, dies, and experiences dissatisfaction and suffering. The koshas are anamaya, pranamaya, manomaya, vijnanamaya, anandamaya, and asmitamaya. So anamaya is the physical body, and pranamaya, the breath or energy body. Manamaya is feelings and emotions. Vijnanamaya, cognitions and the mental self. Anandamaya is joy or bliss. And asmitamaya, the ego eye or the sense of self. The first two sheaths, anamaya and pranamaya, form the physical self. The next two, manamaya and vijnanamaya, form the mental self. And the fifth, anandamaya, is the spiritual or blissful self. Now, traditionally, there are just five koshas. However, in my training with Dr. Richard Miller in IRS meditation, he pointed out that the sense of I-ness is very pervasive and also acts as a sheath of misidentification as a result of lifetimes of conditioning by the I-thought construct, and therefore deserves a whole kosha for itself rather than being included within the Vijnanamaya kosha. So while it is new to include asmitamaya in the kosha model, it is not a term that Richard made up, but rather is from Sankhya, Patanjali, Advaita, Kashmir Shaivism, and the teachings of Buddha. In other schools, for example, the Bihar School of Yoga, manamaya and vijnanamaya are described as the mental body and the wisdom body, respectively. But as my teacher is Richard Miller, and I follow the way that I learned from him, but, you know, really feel free to follow the way that you have learned and that works for you. So it's important to note that mental illness affects all the koshas, not just our emotions. A depressed person's body may be slumped, tired, sore, or feeling heavy, which is anamaya. Their energy may be low and their breathing restricted and shallow, pranamaya. They may feel sadness, manamaya, have ruminative thoughts of hopelessness and helplessness and other negative thoughts, vijnanamaya. They may feel disconnected from their innate sense of joy, anandamaya. And they may define themselves as depressed, as they say, I am depressed, or I'm down, or even my depression, which is asmitamaya. An anxious person may be fidgety, holding tension in their jaw, shoulders, hands, or other parts of their body, and they might have digestive issues, which is anamaya. Their energy may be erratic and their breathing short and shallow, pranamaya. They may talk quickly, they may feel anxiety or nervous, which is manamaya. They may also have ruminative thoughts of not being good enough or not being able enough, vijnanamaya. They may feel disconnected with their innate sense of joy, anandamaya, and they may define themselves as an anxious person, as they say, I am anxious, or my anxiety, as mitamaya. A trauma survivor may present as either depressed, anxious, or both, and they're often not present in their body. While mental health affects all the koshas, the focus in a mental health aware yoga class is on anamaya and pranamaya in order to foster safety and support students to inhabit their bodies. Focusing on the other koshas is important, but it's better suited to one-on-one work with an experienced mental health professional. If you really enjoy offering mental health aware yoga classes, perhaps you'd like to train more in this area and offer this down the track. So staying with anamaya and pranamaya is about staying within your scope of practice as a yoga teacher. It's about offering safe and appropriate practices for a group setting. But there's also real magic in staying out of the story and cognitions and supporting people to inhabit their bodies. It's a real gift. Let's turn to the kleshas now. So one big difference between yoga psychology and Western psychology is that the focus is not on mental illness, but rather on purifying and removing obstacles of thought and action in order to attain higher states of consciousness. The word klesha translates to mean obstacle or affliction. Kleshas are considered to cause the fluctuations of the mind, to strengthen the influence of the gunas, you remember tamas and rajas, right? And to obstruct the mind from realizing the nature of the true self and obtaining samadhi. In chapter 2, verse 3 of the Yoga Sutras, Patanjali outlines the five kleshas.
Avidya, asmita, raga, dvesha, abhinivesah, kleshah.
The word klesha is often used as a synonym for dukkha or suffering, and samskaras, habitual movements of the mind, are perpetuated as a result of the kleshas. We're going to get to samskaras shortly. The five kleshas are avidya, incorrect comprehension, asmita, ego, raga, attachment, devesya, aversion, and abhinivesha, clinging to life. Let's have a look at the kleshas a little more closely now. Let's start with avidya. So vidya means correct understanding, and avidya is the opposite, incorrect comprehension. The goal of yoga is to reduce the veil of avidya in order to see things clearly as they are and to act appropriately. Chapter 2, verse 5 of the Yoga Sutras state,
Anitya, Ashuchi, Dukkha, Anatmasu, Nitya, Shuchi, Sukha, Atmakhyatihi, Avidya.
Avidya is in play when we mistake something that is impermanent as permanent, or something that is impure as pure, or something that is changing as unchanging. In this illustration from the Heart of Yoga by T.K.V. Desikachar, avidya is seen as the root cause of the four branches or obstacles that prevent us from seeing things as they really are. The branches are asmita, raga, devesya, and abhinivesya. Let's look at these four branches now. Asmita is the ego or the I thought. Asmita's essential characteristic is possessiveness and ownership, and leads the individual to think, I am important, I know better, this is mine and that's yours. It creates the illusion that everything is separate and personal. All of the koshas, including sensations, breath, energy, emotions, thoughts and memories, are objective movements that rise and fall within awareness. They are impersonal. The action of asmita is to make everything personal. So we say, I am sad versus sadness is arising, or I am thirsty versus thirst is occurring, or I am happy versus happiness is present. Asmita appropriates everything for itself. Asmita gives rise to raga and devesya, the afflictions of attachment and aversion. Let's look at these kleshas in a little more detail now. So raga is the attachment of the mind to appealing objects and circumstances. It is reinforced by the feeling of pleasure surrounding the desired object. And when these attachments are repeated, they become more deeply seated in the unconscious mind. This results in a never-ending cycle of chasing after pleasure without obtaining permanent happiness, as there is no end to the acquisition of money, possessions, fame, lust, and power. Devesa is the aversion or rejection of things, such as people, thoughts, or settings, in order to avoid discomfort or pain. If we had an experience of discomfort or pain in the past, we may avoid a similar situation as we assume that it will bring pain or discomfort again. Or if we've had no experience with something, we might avoid it due to a fear for the potential for pain or discomfort, even though we have no prior experience with it. In his commentary on the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, Edward Bryant translates Abhinivesa to mean fear of death or the will to live, and highlights that Vyasa, believed to be an ancient sage who wrote the original commentary on the Yoga Sutras, believes that this fear of death is because we have experienced death before and therefore cling strongly to life. TKV Desikachar translates Abhinivesa to simply mean fear, including feeling uncertain, having doubts about our position in life, feeling people that will judge us negatively, not wanting to grow old. And Saraswati Vasudevan adds to this list feeling unsafe and fearing the death of parts of ourself if they're not affirmed. Interesting, right? It's a common human experience to encounter all five kleshas on a regular basis, as they are the nature of the mind. On the path of yoga, we aim to compassionately notice when they arise, to loosen their bonds and lovingly creating new samskaras instead. When I first heard about the kleshas in my yoga studies, I felt like a bad yogi, as not only did the kleshas pretty much infuse every moment of my waking life, but in truth, I didn't want to rid myself of many of them, particularly my attachment to my loved ones and having a pleasant and comfortable life. But working with the kleshas doesn't mean that you need to try to completely eradicate them from your life. You don't need to leave your wife and children behind, as Buddha reportedly did, or decide to forego all pleasures on the spiritual path. The kleshas show us the veils of illusion that cloak the reality of life and call us to wake up to these and act accordingly. Discussing the kleshas directly in your general yoga class may be confusing or unhelpful for someone experiencing mental health challenges, so there's no need to do this explicitly. However, it is important that we recognize them in ourselves and avoid entanglement in them as much as possible. Let's look at samskaras now. The kleshas lie dormant in the unconscious mind and form latent impressions called samskaras. Samskaras are the habitual or conditioned movements of the mind. This photo was taken years ago, just a few days after my daughter was born. One night around this time, I was soothing her to sleep in the early hours of the morning, and after she'd finally fallen back to sleep, I stumbled my way in the dark towards the bathroom. Making my way around the toys scattered lying on the floor, I picked up what I thought was a children's toy from the floorboards, but it was actually a tiny snake. I didn't realize until I'd picked it up, and I felt it squirm in my hand, and with fear and surprise, I flung it across the room. The samskaras from that experience are still with me, and I still squirm just thinking about it, and I continue to be vigilant about keeping the doors in my house closed so it doesn't happen again. In addition, the impression is retrieved spontaneously when I see or I think about a snake or when I'm walking around a dimly lit room scattered with toys. With the retrieval of the memory comes also the retrieval of the aversion and the fear that I experienced in my initial encounter with the snake, and this affects how I react in the moment. Now, this samskara is formed by a somewhat mild traumatic event that left a deep impression on me. It only took a moment, but due to the intensity of the experience, a samskara was nevertheless formed that continues to play out in similar situations in my life. Oh, I feel uncomfortable just looking at that image. Samskaras are also commonly formed through repetitive thoughts, emotions, and behaviors. For example, if as a child you watched your mother reach for chocolate when she was sad, you too might develop the samskara of reaching for chocolate when you're feeling down, simply through watching her repetitive, habitual behavior. As you, in turn, habitually eat chocolate when you're feeling sad, this association will be strengthened and the samskara reinforced. In this example of chocolate and sadness, both raga, attachment, and devesya, aversion, are at play. Aversion to feeling pain, sadness, and attachment to wanting to be comfortable. that samskaras are habits that are formed when thoughts and behaviors leave impressions on the mind is similar to Donald Hebb's theory of the adaptation of brain neurons during the learning process. This theory is commonly summarized as neurons that fire together, wire together. Every thought, emotion, sensation, or behavior triggers thousands of neurons that form a neural network. And when something is repeated over and over again, the brain triggers the same neurons each time. In his book, The Biology of Belief, Dr. Bruce Lipton uses the term subconscious programs to talk about samskaras. Lipton reports that neuroscience has found that these subconscious programs are running our lives 95% of the time, and the conscious mind is only in charge about 5% of the time. I'm not sure exactly how he came to these exact percentages. However, it's clear that the unconscious mind is frequently running the show. Interestingly, research has shown that the unconscious precedes the conscious mind. So a behavioral impulse is generated unconsciously, and then the consciousness claims and experiences it as its own afterwards. Isn't that fascinating? In Western scientific literature, there's been very little discussion about exactly where these unconscious impulses come from. But as Barg and Rosala say in their article titled The Unconscious Mind, it is nice to know that the unconscious is minding the store when the owner is absent. Given that we're running on these subconscious programs or samskaras for most of the day, we're going to be most effective and happy if these programs are working for us rather than against us. Through yoga, we aim to create new samskaras that are sattvic, that is positive, life-enhancing, and bringing us closer to the goal of yoga, rather than reinforcing the old samskaras that are limiting us and acting as a veil to see things clearly and as they really are. Instead of eating chocolate, which might have a short-term rajasic effect and a long-term tamasic one, a more life-enhancing response to sadness might be mindfulness meditation, deep rest, asana, or a pranayama practice. In our classes, we can support our students to find practices that they can use when they're feeling depressed, anxious, or stressed. And the more our students turn to these practices instead of other methods such as chocolate, getting stoned, mindlessly scrolling through their social media feed, or getting caught up in a ruminative storm of self-criticism, the weaker the old samskaras and the stronger the new samskaras become. I like the following analogy to illustrate this process. Imagine that you're walking in a grassy field and that you've been walking a particular path across the field for your whole life. Over the years, the path that you're walking has worn down so that there's a very clear dirt track in an otherwise overgrown field. And then one day you decide that you want to do things differently. So you head off in the field in a different direction. To begin with, the field is very overgrown and it's difficult to make your way through the grass. But each time you come to this field, you make a conscious decision to walk the new path. Initially, it comes with challenges, but over time, the old path grows over and the new path becomes easier and easier to walk until eventually it becomes so easy to choose that path, you don't even have to think about it anymore. So the original path in this story might be the automatic reaching for chocolate when you're feeling sad. And the new path might be noticing that sadness is present and then choosing to practice Nadi Shodhana or Shavasana. And each time you choose the new path, you're actually rewiring your brain. Each action you take is having a physiological effect on your brain. This is neuroscience, but it's also in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. Chapter 1, verse 50 reads,
Tajya samskaraha anya samskara pratibandhi.
When the new samskaras are strong enough, the old ones will eventually fall away and no longer affect us. Let's talk briefly now about non-dualism. The philosophies of Sankhya and Patanjali are dualistic in nature, such that what is seen, Prakriti, and what sees, Purusha, is considered to be separate. What is seen, Prakriti, and what sees, Purusha, are considered to be separate. The later philosophies of Advaita Vedanta and Kashmir Shaivism are non-dualistic in nature, such that what is seen, Prakriti, and what sees, Purusha, is considered to be non-separate or non-dual. Non-dualism states that we are all interconnected and not separate, that we are one with all creation, or rather not two, non-dual. And as a result, suffering arises when we perceive ourselves as separate. Well, the concept of non-dualism is simple. As most of us have deeply entrenched conditioning to the contrary, it can be difficult to intellectually understand it. My favorite way of making sense of the idea of non-dualism or oneness is likening it to the ocean. The waves of the ocean rise and fall. And as they rise, they take on the unique shape and speed and character until they fall back into and merge with the ocean. The wave was always the ocean, but for a moment it became its own unique individual expression. Just like the waves, we all take on our own unique and individual expression with our own shapes and speeds and characters, yet we all come from the same stuff. Or as Joni Mitchell sang in her song Woodstock in the 1970s, "We are stardust." Interestingly, it turns out that Joni Mitchell's lyrics are supported by science. According to astrophysicists, everything in the universe and on Earth, including us, is made up of remnants of stars and massive explosions in the galaxies. And this stardust continues to float through us, rebuilding our bodies over and over during our lifetime. We are all made up of the same stardust. We are one. The koshas are sheaths of misidentification that are responsible for our belief in us being separate and limited individuals. Many of us identify strongly with our bodies, our emotions, and our minds, yet these koshas are simply tools to help us to navigate and understand the world. They do not define who we are, and believing so keeps us separate and in suffering. Richard Miller says, "Suffering and conflict co-arise when separation is believed to be real and the only reality that exists. And overcoming this root belief of separation is necessary to dispel conflict, anxiety, fear, dissatisfaction, and suffering." Again, talking about non-dualism in your general yoga class may be confusing or unhelpful for someone experiencing mental illness, so there's no need to do this explicitly. However, it is important to understand human suffering through this lens. Okay, so that was an introduction to the foundations of yoga psychology. It's a brief overview, but I wanted to give you some background of yoga psychology to support you on your own journey and with your work with mental health. Thanks for joining me.